and we complete the cycle. Where I'd like to complete the cycle, though, is where we began. So at the end and at the beginning, as things always are, every end is a beginning. We're still in the theme of equanimity, but I'd like to have it completely permeated by the very beginning, and that is of loving kindness. So I thought to utterly astonish you and use very few words and focus on the theme of loving kindness in an even way, but in every even way. And that is to bring to mind this extraordinary hypothesis, which entails a radically, radically different way of viewing reality. So different. It's absolutely revolutionary, and it's utterly ancient. And that is, insofar as we really apply our path, apply ourselves, devote ourselves with all our hearts, strength, might, everything, to the path of Dharma. And bearing in mind that the word Dharma actually means reality. And it doesn't mean a religion. It doesn't mean Buddhism versus Hinduism, Mahayana versus Theravada. Dharma means reality. So devoting ourselves to a path that is real, and being real that is good, that insofar as we do so, insofar as the motivation is clear, the motivation is strong, the dedication to practice is there, that all that we truly need, which takes some real wisdom to recognize on occasion, but all that we truly need rises up to meet us, that in fact reality is friendly. Friendly insofar as we're devoting ourselves to Dharma, insofar as we're devoting ourselves to hedonic pleasure, reality is karma. Neither friendly nor unfriendly, any more than a plot of soil is friendly or unfriendly. If you sow one type of seed and you nurture it, you'll get that type of harvest. So another type of seed, another kind of harvest. That's not friendly. That's just what you put in, you get out. And we have so many cliches on that theme that none of them need to be repeated. But there it is, and I think it really is true. But frankly, from my perspective, it really only makes sense if one sees the sowing and the reaping beyond the context of one life. To my mind, that's the only way it's sensible. But if we come back to Dharma, which is why we all came here, then the theme that insofar as we really apply ourselves, reality does rise up to meet us, is extraordinarily profound. I think it's utterly and deeply true, profoundly related to the deepest view, to my mind, the great perfection, the Dzogchen view, of this nature of pristine awareness and its fundamentally ground role in reality as a whole. But when I say this, I think it's very important to add that none of us must be naive, and I don't think any of you would be, but I'll say it anyway. And that is when we dedicate ourselves to Dharma and then have a sense, all right, I'm going to put this great hypothesis to the test, and I'm going to see whether reality rises up to meet me. And then 3 weeks later we learn that we need an operation. Say, oh, that didn't work out very well. I applied myself to Dharma, and now I need an operation. I have kidney failure, I have this, or whatever. I got malaria, something happened. Oh, reality sucks, this didn't work out. So the notion that if we apply ourselves to Dharma, that from that point on, everything's just going to be as smooth as silk, is complete fantasy. Because that really would not be serving us in the best way. It's so commonly taught that among the six perfections, all of which will be brought to fulfillment as we achieve perfect enlightenment, of generosity, of ethics, of patience, of enthusiasm, meditation, and wisdom, that for these to arise and come to their perfection, then there need to be circumstances that catalyze that. And it's not simply meeting one fortunate circumstance after another. Fortunate in the sense that everybody in the world would recognize, oh, good, you just won the lottery. And after that, oh, you had extremely good health for the rest of your life. And after that, you just encountered only nice people from then on, and you only had good health, and you grew old, but you got handsomer and handsomer as you grew older. You must be really practicing Dharma. Now we're definitely into Goofy Tunes land that we've left reality. So this is where understanding Dharma, and in the classic teachings, we find it very explicitly in the Tibetan tradition and other traditions as well. But the sequence being one of learning Dharma, and from that deriving the wisdom, the understanding of hearing, the understanding that arises from then of pondering, reflecting upon, really wrestling with, trying to make sense of and weave into one's own life, the understanding the understanding arising from thinking, contemplation, reflection, and then finally coming to the wisdom that derives from meditation. There's a tremendous wisdom in that. And the more we understand Dharma, the richer our understanding, the broader our understanding, that Dharma is not simply sitting on the cushion. You can be sitting on the cushion and not practicing Dharma, and you can be walking all over the place and practicing Dharma. The Dharma is not simply a posture, it's not simply a practice. That Dharma entails transforming everything that comes along into nourishment, into sustenance, into food, so that we're really, in a way, devouring reality, like great insatiable appetite. And so whatever comes, it's aging, it's illness, it's difficulties, it's environmental challenges that may arise, and so forth and so on, to be able to have such a rich understanding and such a sincere, dedicated, persevering motivation to apply all that we know so that we do indeed transform everything. I give my favorite analogy for that. You know that I lived for some time, more than a year, with the Dalai Lama's personal physician, and then I served as an interpreter for years after that. And he made a comment, I can't remember whether I told you this very brief story, but it was in those very early days, 72 or so, and we were just looking out over the land, outside of, you know, just out over the landscape, and Dr. Ishidunan commented to me, said, you know, a really good Tibetan doctor, and we're looking at the natural land. We're not looking at plastic bags and, you know, artificial stuff that the human beings create, but of the natural landscape with its animals, its plants, its minerals, and so forth. He said, a good Tibetan doctor can take anything here, anything, and turn it into medicine. Dirt, leaves, bark, anything. I can use it all. And he was consummate. That the good Tibetan doctor knows how to, everything here can be medicine. Not medicine for everybody, but medicine for someone. Someone, oh, I can use that soil. Someone, oh, I can use that leaf. Oh, someone, I can use that poison. Someone, I can use that dead snake that somebody found. And they actually found a dead snake and he used it. You know, didn't kill it, but he found a dead, oh, I can use that. Brought in the dead snake, you know. And so that marvelous ability to transform everything into medicine, I think, is one of the most powerful metaphors we have, that it's all nurturing. It's all nurturing. And so one can say, oh, I see, this is kind of like a psychological ploy. And I understand people thinking that. That this is making, how many cliches do we have? This is learning how to make lemonade out of lemons. You know, when something really rotten happens, you're clever enough, you're smart enough, that you learn how to transform it into something that's fortuitous, something beneficial to you, and so you earn a big badge of cleverness. I don't refute that. But from my own experience, limited, of course, as it is, there is obviously a wisdom in learning how to adapt to transform, to shape, to work with whatever life dishes up. And that's a psychological ability, it's a type of wisdom. And it could be that that's all we're dealing with. And in fact, it is just a great big mindless machine out there, and we just have to be as clever and as wise as we can to deal with it. That's one view. But the Buddhist view is not that one. Certainly the responsibility is on us to learn the Dharma, to get a richer and richer understanding, and not only intellectually, but through hearing, thinking, meditation, experientially, so whatever comes up, we find this too, as someone said to me, I've gotten so much grist for my mill, you know, that everything becomes grist for the mill, which means everything can be transformed. So on the one hand, certainly the responsibility is here. There's no question of that. But on the other hand, and here's where the real powerful hypothesis comes in, there's more to it than that. It's not only, you know, be wise, be strong, be dedicated, and try to transform everything that happens into your ongoing spiritual maturation. But in fact, and it's so bold, it's stunning, it's magnificent, to think that it's more than that, that reality actually does rise up to meet you in ways over which you have no control, but are utterly beyond, they are transcendent. And what you need from moment to moment really does start to arise. And it's been my experience. So much so that when I finally found the Dharma that, how do you say, was my path, I was 20 years old. I found the book on the Great Perfection. I said, this is it. This is it. I couldn't learn much more because there was so little in English or any Western language. But from that point of just finding, ah, here's my path, from that point, it just, reality started opening up. Meeting this Buddhist monk out there in the middle of the wilderness in Norway, you know, I mean, I think you know the story, but meeting with him and then coming to Göttingen and finding there was a Tibetan Lama waiting for me. And then one thing after another, going to India, there Yishudundan offered me the invitation, and just one thing after another, going out for a walk with Klaus, and welcome to our walk, you know, having dinner for Klaus, there's going to be the observatory. You know, one thing after another after another. And this is not me being clever. This is not, wow, you really managed to transform that one, didn't you? Good for you, you turned lemons into lemonade. This wasn't me, right? It was just an idea. And then opened up. So, to proceed along that line, I'd like to go back to the meditation. In the spirit of loving kindness, first of all, for ourselves. Even if this is very tentative, and I utterly understand and embrace that, this notion, if you think, gosh, is that even plausible? Could it be? Because we've been so hammered with the notion that the world is just a world of physics. It's blind, it's a great machine, and don't get caught in the cogs. You know, that it's just this blind, uncaring, unconscious universe. Because, of course, that's the only one they know how to study. They're looking at the objective, the physical, quantifiable. What else are they going to come up with? But I think getting out of that pigeonhole, that little peanut-sized universe, and opening up to the grander vision is certainly worth a try. And so as we consider that, the notion that we're never alone, we're not simply isolated, wandering around on this planet for a few decades, trying to eke out a little bit of happiness and then dying, that in fact that is an extremely impoverished notion and an unrealistic notion. The notion that in fact we're engaged here, we are full participants in reality, and it rises up to meet us when we rise up to meet it. When we get real to reality, reality gets real to us. That is reciprocal. It's an extraordinarily different way of viewing reality. And it gives rise to something that's quite familiar, a profound sense of ease. A profound sense of ease. And I don't have much experience in that, but I've met people who just live as we're coming to this theme of equanimity. I remember Genjama Wandu, one of the most seasoned, wizened, extraordinary yogis I've ever met, the one that lived on those flower essence pills. I remember him saying to me, with just this lightness, this utter lightness, joyousness, but so light, so utterly free of attachment. I never saw him be attached to anything at all, abstract or concrete. He just commented to me one day, you know, whether I live or die, it's even. And I can imagine a person being depressed and saying that. I can imagine a person, all kinds of people saying that for a myriad of reasons. Tired of life, ennui, apathy, giving up. Oh, so many reasons one might say, I don't care whether I live or die, maybe I want to die, and then killing themselves. But that wasn't it. There was no apathy. There was a love of Dharma. There was a dedication of Dharma. There was a warmth. Kindness. A radiance. But an evenness. An evenness. That he was living well, he would die well, and whatever reality was dished up. That was fine. You know? Quite extraordinary. So as we return to the practice, this great fusion of loving kindness and compassion, if we refer to Anit Sepel's question, what would happen if we started with equanimity? Well, let's start with equanimity and let's start with loving kindness and make them non-dual, right? And so the simple practice I would suggest today is to first, especially as we bring this time together, physically together, to a close, to breathe in. Breathe in with loving kindness. As you call upon the universe, the world around you, your Dharma friends, the surrounding environment, the world of sentient beings, may all that we truly need arise up and meet us. And breathe it in. Breathe it in. and then in a display of gratitude or simply loving kindness, breathe out. Breathe out evenly in all directions. May we all be well and happy. And just breathe out a light from your heart and imagine it be so. Shall we keep it simple? Is that good? Let our first act of kindness in this session be to set the body at ease in a state of equilibrium in which the relaxation, the looseness, the comfort of the body is balanced in stillness with the quality of vigilance. Step back and allow your body to restore and to refine its own balance, its own equilibrium, by settling your respiration in its natural rhythm, uninhibited, unrestrained, and effortless, breathing as if you were deep asleep. Settle your mind with the three qualities by way of mindfulness of breathing, just for a little while. And as we move into the main practice, I invite you to tap into and embrace the deepest impulse possibly in your whole existence, and the deepest impulse in the existence of every sentient being. And that is the impulse of caring. Caring about your own well-being, which we all do, we never learn it, we already had it. And then as we open our eyes, we care for those who are close to us. And as we open our hearts, we may care for all of those around us without barrier. So arouse the spirit, this impulse of deeply caring about your own well-being, which includes the hedonic, the relative or mundane, that all of your basic needs are met, and it then ascends to the heights of genuine happiness, your ultimate fulfillment. With each in-breath, arouse this yearning. May I be truly well and happy. And from breath to breath, imagine generally and imagine with specificity reality rising up to meet you and providing you with all that you truly need. Breathe in the light and the loving kindness, the compassion of the world around you, and let it fill your being. In this aspiration, you may, if you wish, entrust yourself to the compassion, the enlightened activities of the enlightened ones of the three times, past, present, and future, that you live and pass your days in a field of blessing. As you turn to enlightenment, enlightenment turns to you. Let your awareness expand with every out-breath. Breathe out this light of loving kindness. With a wish that each one within these walls, these transparent walls, and that each one outside of these transparent walls, may each one find the happiness they seek, their heart's desire. May each be well and happy. And evenly breathe out this light of loving kindness. And let's bring this session to a close. So, to pick up a little bit more on that theme, in Buddhist terminology, on the one hand, the ripening of karma, natural laws, but not laws of physics, but really one can call them, one can say that there is an ethics, an ethic in the very fabric of reality. But it's not a Buddhist ethic or a Christian ethic, it's not imposed by some god outside to punish and reward. Seems to me that it's more a matter of living in accordance with reality, and when we do so, the harvest from doing so is experienced as well-being, or good fortune, high fertility, very, how do you say, fertile circumstances for spiritual growth, for finding happiness. Whereas when we act out of accord with reality, then we grind against reality, and the result is friction, which we experience as misfortune. And so as we sow, so shall we reap, theme that runs through all of Buddhism and so many other wisdom traditions, that as we engage in an action, a deliberate, intentional action, the seeds are sown. Unless those seeds are burnt, unless we undo, disempower those seeds, then one could say, laws of karma is that that seed will remain in the mind stream. And there is a certitude that it will eventually bear fruit, whether it's 1,000 lifetimes from now or whether it's in the same lifetime. Both can happen. But unless it's burnt, unless it's negated somehow, then it will definitely give rise to its corresponding result. So one can easily wonder, well, if that's the case, that we really are, in a way, in command of, or we are certainly cultivating, we are responsible for our future, and as we are receiving the, how do you say, harvesting, the harvest from the past, so are we sowing in the present. In that mode, then one could wonder, well, this seems like a closed system. Like I'm experiencing now the results of past karma, right now I'm accruing further karma for which I'll experience the results in the future. It sounds closed within my own little cycle, within reality, within samsara. But it's not closed. Or once it could say it is closed, let's do a gradient. That is, insofar as I'm operating out of a base delusion that my happiness is really lying out there, that I will take seriously that the phenomena around me are really stable and enduring. So I will take the impermanent and I'll grasp onto that as permanent, enduring. I'll take grasp onto that which is not a true source of happiness as being a true source of happiness. And I will assume that I'm an independent, autonomous agent waging my way, you know, venturing through reality. And the way to find happiness is to massage reality and massage other people, get them to behave in the proper way and find the right acquisitions and the right environment and the right health, and let's go to it and be really clever and pursue hedonic well-being. Then you are, in a way, in your own little world, and you are sowing as you reap. Are you reaping as you sow? Which way? It's all cyclical. In which case, yeah, you're on your own. You're operating out of your own little dream, your own little non-lucid dream, and there you go. But when we open up and start to get clear, recognizing the impermanent is the impermanent and so forth, with the three marks of existence, and gain a clear and clearer vision, what does it mean to flourish? what is genuine happiness, what is a path to awakening, then to that extent we come out of our own individual little cycle, our own little individual substrate with its own seeds and its maturation, our own little encapsulated samsara, and we're coming out into a broader reality, which means that we're not free of karma, but now there's something complex and really quite mysterious that takes place. And that is, as we step onto the path of dharma, it doesn't mean now that we're free of all karma, that we'll experience no more misfortune. It doesn't mean that we're no longer accruing any further karma. That happens only when you become an arya, remember? Dembatona pempa me. Once you've seen reality, there is no more propulsive karma. Dembatona pempa me in Tibetan. A few things I still remember. Once you've gained that direct, non-conceptual, unmediated realization of dhammata, ultimate reality, dhamma dhatu, absolute space of phenomena. From that point, there's still karma, but you're no longer propelling yourself into reality in your own little enclosed samsara, because you've seen what's going on, you become lucid. But karma still matures, karma still ripens, even for the Arya Bodhisattva, even for the Arhat, which is really quite striking, but it's very, very clear in the Buddhist teachings, even for the Arhat, who has finished his or her path, even for the Arhat, karma still ripens for that lifetime, then finished, right? And so what is this interface? Even for the Arya Bodhisattvas, even for the Arhat, karma still manifesting? Well, then what's the use? In Buddhist terminology, what's the use of the blessings of the Buddha? How can they get in when we are sowing and we're reaping, sowing and we're reaping and sowing and so forth? And how they get in is not something just coming outside and displacing, but something coming in like an elixir and transmuting. And so when we experience adversity, now I'm speaking straight Buddhist view, when we encounter adversity, illness, tragedy, what the world would call adversity, first response from Buddhist perspective, this is a maturation of previous karma. And it may be massive. It may be massive. I mean, what happened for the Tibetan people? That was pretty large. That was pretty large. There was no aspect of their culture, I think simply no aspect at all, of a whole culture, of a whole civilization that wasn't touched, damaged, really damaged by the invasion, the occupation, the genocide that they have experienced and to a mitigated but nevertheless relentless degree continue to experience. Now, some of the younger Tibetans, I think, are maybe losing sight of the wisdom of their own tradition. But the older ones, I'll say my age and older, because I was born in the year they were invaded, 1950. The older ones, they haven't lost sight of the wisdom of generations and generations before them. And they have accepted, but really radically non-passively, radically non-apathetically, the tragedy that struck them. They're some of the most non-apathetic people I've ever met as a culture. They're not all virtuous, so I'm not saying they're all utopian, nothing like that, that's not true. But non-apathetic, boy, is that true. Because as I was living in this refugee community only 11 years, 12 years after they escaped from Tibet, I never met an apathetic person. I met a few people who went mentally deranged. There were a couple that, you know, just the calamity, it collapsed them. And so, no, not it was just a community. But they were absolutely not apathetic. And they had the lights. It was like a well-lit room, that little community of Dharamsala. In the well-lit room, there were so many lights of His Holiness, Tijan Rinpoche, Ling Rinpoche, kept Sirkun Rinpoche, one lama after another, the yogis up on the hill, geshe this, geshe that, geshe the geshe all over the place, monks and nuns. There were so many lights, that so much tragedy of darkness, but so much light. And overall, there was an acceptance that although we as this in this generation, 1950, 1960, and so forth, and then the horrible years of the Cultural Revolution, so much suffering for the Chinese people, and all of the Han Chinese, for the ethnic minorities all over China, so much suffering. It's as if they were just intent on creating a hell realm out of China. And of course, the Tibetans included in that. Even during that time, a basic orientation, that what's arising now, what's manifesting, what we're experiencing, this is the fruit of our past karma. Let's not replicate that. Whatever could give rise to this type of adversity in the present moment, let's not perpetuate that by further anger, further vengeance, further hatred, further mental afflictions. Let's cut it here and now. Accept this is the fruition of the past, but not the past in this lifetime. If you look what the Tibetans did in the 1940s and 1950s, that was not a horrendously evil culture. It was really pretty benign. It had its problems like any other culture, but they'd done nothing. Tibetan people had done nothing to the Chinese people any more than the Chinese people prior to that had done something terrible to Tibetans. This was old karma manifesting in a group. Group karma manifesting group-wise. But the point here is, I think it was a tremendous solace. It allowed a sense of equilibrium, a sense of coming to evenness. It's a maturation of past karma. It's happening. Let's deal with it. Just kind of like almost brusque. Just blunt, straight. Let's just deal with it. Same thing in Mongolia earlier. You know, some awful things happened. 1930s. Terrible, terrible things happened under the Stalin regime. But let's just deal with it. Let's not wallow in self-pity. Let's not think about the good old days. Let's not go the obvious route of anger, retaliation, vengeance. This is the maturation of our karma. In this case, it was the Chinese communists that were instruments for delivering the fruition of our own karma. So let's just deal with it and not accumulate further negative. And let's arise. And to the ability, to the best of ability we can, let's see if we can now transmute this. Transmute this, which by any standards outside would be, say, what a tragedy, it's genocide, it's awful. All right, that's what the world thinks. But now one by one, and in my own personal experience, my most radiant example is Gen Gungobashi, who taught me the 7-point mind training. I don't know that many people experienced much more suffering than he did. It wasn't physical, he managed to escape. But the personal tragedy of his life and so forth, I won't go into the details, but I can imagine many people just collapsing under the weight of the adversity that he had experienced, he and his wife. And there he was, one of the most peaceful and serene people, warm and kind and giving, so giving, that I've ever met in my life. So he simply took his wisdom and transmuted it and said to me, and it almost makes me, gosh, it's hard to say, but he said to me, the Chinese communist brought great blessing. Great blessing. Oh, he inspired me. And it really was. They did. They did. They brought him great blessing. He transmuted it. He had the wisdom. He rose. He matured. He deepened in his practice. So it's in the midst of that karma that the blessings come. They're not coming and displacing the karma. They're coming in the midst of his karma so that the karma, how it manifests, when it manifests, how it manifests, all of this can be saturated by the blessings of the Buddha. So again, this is Buddha speak. This is Buddha talk. But can be saturated by it. So then even when the negative karma manifests, because of the blessings, the ripeness here and what is manifesting, that even when the adversity arises, this is not, oh, now there's no blessing, now it's adversity. The blessing is coming by way of the adversity, transmuting it, and truly is blessing. It is truly what we need at that time. So it's quite mysterious, but I think it's not just speculation. That's my sense. So we had an example yesterday that at least some people, I think, probably found troubling, and for good reason. How could a person with such malevolence, even though it was malevolence that was assigned to him, and that is milarepa. I mean, when I describe what he did and the motivation, it was horrendous. It was really, really awful, right? How could anybody that does that degree of evil in one lifetime, in the same lifetime, become enlightened? I mean, he doesn't deserve it. He should be punished someplace. He should have to experience some real deep hell or something, but he shouldn't be able to get away with it. Maybe something like that. He shouldn't be able to get away with that. Killing 33 people and doing it with such malevolence, even though his mama told him to, you know, and she did, I mean, that was it, you know, wreak vengeance on the people who've destroyed our family. Nevertheless, he did it. He was responsible for his own deeds. But I didn't quite finish the story. So this tremendous, absolutely from the ground of his being, remorse at what he'd done when he saw when he saw it. He actually fulfilled all of his mama's wishes. And just, it was brought catastrophe upon those who had deliberately brought catastrophe to his little family of his mom and his sister and him. Then with this absolutely pure, intense motivation, seeking out, finding his teacher, Marpa, Marpa accepting him, and then the trials that Marpa put him through, I don't know in the history of Buddhism, and again, I'm just expressing my limitation, I don't know in the history of Buddhism anyone who has put through such trials, such torture, as Milarepa was. It was not just building a tower. It was one tower after another. But it wasn't just that. I mean, one of my students has had now, who went splendidly through one of the 3-month shamatha retreats, came out with a strong motivation to practice, and has been in pretty much in retreat ever since. Splendid, excellent motivation, discipline, ethics, really excellent. He's built now 4 cabins. He didn't want to build 4 cabins. He wanted one to be able to live in it, but that never worked out. He'd build a cabin, then need to move. Okay, got some new land. Okay, I'll build a cabin. Whoop, that didn't work out. Okay, bump, build a new cabin. Whoop, that didn't work out. Okay, fourth cabin, you know? Well, it's just building cabins. I mean, Key's a contractor. It's not torture to build a cabin, right? It's just hard work. But the way that Milarepa had to build his cabins, the way his teacher appeared to him, was just a nasty old bugger who was drunk half the time. That's how he appeared to him. Really, isn't that exactly right? On the one hand, he had this powerful intuition that this farmer, hyphen translator, maybe gentleman farmer and translator, was truly, truly a capable spiritual guide that could lead him all the way to enlightenment. He had that intuition, he had that core trust. But then how did Marpa manifest to him once the link was made, once the trust was established? Once the trust was established, from Marpa's side, Nietzsche chose the right word. It was among the 4 types of enlightened activity, it was the ferocious kind. Marpa turned blue. Metaphorically, Marpa turned wrathful. He would appear to be drunk. He would appear to contradict himself. He would appear that he didn't care about Milarepa at all. He'd be giving these exalted, noble, esoteric teachings to a few disciples, giving them empowerment, and Milarepa would come scratching the door. Can Kai come in? May I can come in and get the teaching? Get out. Get out. Get lost. Build a tower. Like he didn't care about him, you know. And he'd come back and he'd hardly get any teachings. Build me this. I didn't tell you to build that. Rip that down. Who told you to build that? Take it down. Put every stone back. What are you, jerk? And it seemed like just so tough. It was relentless. And looked like, boy, any from outside to say, Milarepa, find a nice teacher. Find a nice one. You know, there are a lot of nice teachers. They're sweet. They're warm. They give you hugs and kiss on the cheek and all kinds of nice things. Why don't you find somebody much nicer than that? But Milarepa, he knew. He knew, no, this is the one. And he went through it all, and he had a bit of softness there. It didn't come from Marpa, not for that period. It's from Marpa's wife. And she was just like Tara herself. And she provided the solace when it was just unbearable for him, when he just felt, he hates me. He doesn't like me. He'll never give me anything. I can't work with him. And she would make it, she would soothe him. She'd calm him. She would be the mother and get him through. And after just torture, I mean just pain, physical pain, mental anguish, the feeling of being unloved, abandoned, feeling of being deceived and manipulated and exploited, but bear in mind, it didn't start that way. First, the trust was established. You don't just start, you know, that was established. But he must have intuitively felt beyond the veneer, beyond the wrathful manifestation, this is the guru's skillful means. And with Damemas, that is Marpa's wife, with her help, her comforting, when needed, he made it all the way through. And so instead, again, straight Buddhist talk, instead of having to experience, who knows, how long in a hell realm for killing malevolently 35 people, he burned that off because of Marpa's compassionate guidance and the demands he put on him, the anguish he put on him, to burn it all away. And through the purity of his devotion, his faith, his absolute, relentless, unswerving dedication to Dharma, able to burn it away until finally it was done. And then Marpa said, okay, now come. And then, like his jewel disciple, then he bestowed the whole transmission, everything upon him, and said, good, now go. You have everything you need. And then he just went off. And then Marpa Milarepa became the most beloved of all yogis of Tibet. And only praised, sang the praises of Marpa as the enlightened one. Only sang his praises. So karma, it's mysterious. You'll recall the story of Domdumba, with the fellow who's circumambulating the stupa, my favorite story, right? Who is studying, who's meditating, gave the wonderful advice, give up attachment to this life, let your mind become Dharma. Well, his beloved and revered teacher was Atisha himself. And when Atisha was about to pass away, Atisha already knew where he was going. He was going to what in the Mahayana view, so there's a difference here, a view. In the Mahayana view, he was going to a pure land, a Buddha field, known as Tushita. Now, Tushita in Pali is a deva realm. It's in the desire realm, and it's a very wonderful place, but it's within samsara. And so there's something, a different view from the, let's say, from the early Pali canon view, the Theravada view, and the Mahayana. The Mahayana view is that the pure land of Tushita is like a monastery outside of a village, and the village is the deva realm. In the desire realm, the deva realm is like the village, and the pure land of Tushita is like the monastery outside the village. Obviously, it's only a metaphor. But from the Mahayana view, just speaking that, because this is the Mahayana story, Atisha knew that this is where his prayers, his inclinations, what have you, that he was, when he passed away, he would take rebirth in this pure land of Tushita, which is the abode of the coming Buddha, Maitreya. So he'd be spending some time in the midst, in the presence of Maitreya. And his most beloved, his closest disciple, his principal disciple, Domdumba, asked of his teacher, Atisha, will I be able to join you? A lot of emotion coming up today. Will I be able to join you? And Atisha said, yes. That is, yes, you too will join me in Tushita. But you'll get leprosy first. You get leprosy first. So even Domdumba, manifesting, karma manifesting, but a person of this maturity, one can imagine, I think, very realistically, taking even leprosy and dying of leprosy, because back then, what was the treatment? And transmuting that purification, before being able to take birth there. So it's complex. But I think it's real. That's my sense of it. Which then dovetails into a question from Ricardo. I have only one piece of paper today. And maybe I'll go to the second question first, and I think I can just read it. I brought this very helpful though, to bring empty eyeglass carrier. I think I can do it. Well, actually, why don't I just make it easier? Thank you. Bring Elizabeth's glasses. Thank you. Just so I don't have to strain my eyes. Thank you. To Jenna. Does that look bad? You like it? Yeah. Oh, yeah. So the second question first. I've been wanting to ask this since the beginning of the retreat, but wasn't sure it was appropriate, since others wanted me to ask them. So we can pin this on everybody besides Ricardo. And I'll go ahead and ask and blame everybody else, but do not blame me. Is what he doesn't write. In our retreat in January, you mentioned that one of your students in full-time retreat was in stage 8 or 9, no? Stage 7. Could you share with us if this person, he or she, or anyone else from the Shamatha Project has achieved shamatha yet? Have they completely achieved shamatha? We feel it would be very inspiring if this was so, and we could know about it. And I agree with you, and that's not an inappropriate question. First answer, as usual, is I don't know. That's never stopped me before, so I'll continue talking. To the best of my knowledge, but my knowledge is limited, and I have to say I don't know, because I've been teaching for a long time, and it wasn't just the 2-3 month shamatha retreats. It was I assisted in teaching a 1 year retreat back 22 years ago, 1980 through 1988. Is that right? Yeah, 1988, all of 1988. We had a dozen people in that retreat, and I've lost touch with a number of them as they've, you know, they've simply followed their own path and following very teachers. So doing well. But I've not stayed in close contact with all of them. And likewise for these 70 or so people in the 2 shamatha projects. Some I've kept in contact with, and others are simply, you know, following other teachers, following their path, but not sending me emails all the time, so I don't really know. I would say with a lot of confidence, out of the 1 year retreat 22 years ago, and then the 2 3-month shamatha retreats and the shamatha project, and those who continued from that, I would say with a lot of confidence that there are 2 people that I've trained who have achieved stage 7 and were gloriously flourishing in that stage. I mean, doing magnificently. One then followed, and has been followed, a wonderfully qualified Tibetan yogi, and continued for some time after, and so I've lost touch. But I do know, through the grapevine, utterly dedicated to Dharma, quite happy and utterly just living in Dharma, just not doing anything else, just totally dedicated to Dharma. The other one, for the best of reasons, and I won't elaborate because this person's anonymity should be protected, but for the best of the reasons, while the practice was going extraordinarily well, it was necessary to stop being in full retreat. For the best of reasons. I had no qualms. It wasn't even a choice. You must come out of retreat now. This is absolutely necessary. There's no question about it. But therefore then, that momentum of stage 5, 6, 7, when one thinks it's now, it's going to get really easy, it's just kind of sliding downhill, that momentum had to be suspended, postponed, but with absolutely, and I mean absolutely, no disillusionment or any withdrawal. It was just utter enthusiasm, but knowing now I can't continue on that particular trajectory, I need to broaden out. So I would say, because I know this person pretty well, the dedication to Dharma, absolutely undiminished. But it needs to be, for the time being, in a broader base, and not that utter simplicity of lifestyle, which it is, of just going for shamatha. That has to be simple, overall, right? So, and then quite a number of other students who've achieved stages 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Fair number. Now, might there be some, because I've been teaching for 34 years, been teaching shamatha pretty much the whole time, might there be others who've achieved shamatha? Could be. I don't know. But now one might think, well, gosh, you know, all these people practicing. And as far as I know, I can't say, oh, this person among my students, this person achieved shamatha. One might think, gosh, you must be kind of discouraged. You know, maybe we should be discouraged too. Maybe we should be all discouraged together. You know, join hand and kind of wring our hands and cry a little bit could be helpful. Yeah. As you might have noticed, my enthusiasm is unabated. Hasn't diminished, I'm reading the second one before the first one because it ties in with the earlier. I found it very interesting to see what has actually occurred. For it was 14. We had 1 out of 5 out of 70 people. We had 37 in the first retreat, 33 in the second, with a break in between. So it was in the spring and the fall of 2007. Out of 70 people, at the end of the second retreat, 14 of them were completely devoting themselves in solitude or a small cluster of people, but just devoting themselves full-time to the practice of shamatha. And then out of the 14, as time went by, the Santa Barbara Institute had some funding to be able to provide several of them with money for rent and for food, so we were able to support. Then that money gradually got used up. And so the number gradually went down. Nobody had to leave, but this is interesting. Nobody came out of retreat because they couldn't afford it. Nobody just ran out of money and said, well, I guess I can't meditate anymore. Not one. That was never true. Never has been true of any of my students. Oh, can't meditate anymore, no money. They came out for other reasons. Sometimes very good ones, usually very good ones. But the number gradually diminished. I think it went down to maybe 6, 7, 8. And then it started coming up again, and now it's getting more and more, even independent of us here. Someone wrote me this morning, I think it was, or last night, saying, I've now finished something I needed to complete, and now I'm ready to go on to a 1-year shamatha retreat. You know? And I know this person rather well. I think motivation, he's well prepared. But what's interesting for me as the teacher, and a spiritual friend, I mean, you know, what's the difference, is I followed the course of these, more or less a dozen people, and now it's a dozen continuing on, that among those right now that are continuing, not a single one is discouraged. One might think, gosh, why aren't you? Get real. You had a three-month retreat, you've been practicing for 3 years since then, or 2.5 years, something like that. You're not, and you haven't achieved shamatha yet? As far as I know, none of them have achieved shamatha. And so, well, what's this bigness about 1 year, 2 years? You've been going for 2.5 years, and you haven't achieved shamatha. Why don't you, you know, you can be discouraged now, any time would be fine, you know. Why don't you give up? Find something else to do. And in fact, one of them, one very dedicated practitioner amongst that group, has a nice array of talents, his skills he's developed. And I thought about him, and he'd experienced a lot of outside, you know, challenges, obstacles, and so forth. He was, I want to protect his anonymity. Don't really need to, but I'll just do it from on the safe side. But knowing what's happening here with the sports club and all of that, I wrote to him and I said, you know, if you feel you'd like to come out of retreat and be more just socially active for a while, I think you might be able to find employment here with your skill set, your meditative background, and so forth. And I know you well, I'd give you a strong letter of recommendation. So if you'd like to come out, I think there might be something for you that you find really rewarding. Of course, if you want to stay in, of course, you know, either way, I'm happy to support you. And he wrote right back and said, Alan, thanks a lot for the offer, the invitation, but all I want to do is continue in single-pointed practice. So thanks, but no thanks. I just want to stay in practice. And so that's what I found, is that among those, their motivation just gets stronger and stronger. And I think for all of them, for almost all of them, not all, but almost all, when they first started doing this, like 6 months, a year, the parents, in one case, there's a young woman, and the parents, it's a very bright, very well-educated young woman, and the parents were saying, maybe that was enough? You know, why don't you go for a doctorate? Why don't you get a nice husband? How about some grandchildren? Okay, don't overdo it. You know, you can come out now. You know, come. Bambino, bambine. No. Resolved. Now the parents are building her a cabin and want to support her indefinitely. Two brothers. Oh, that gets too specific. Maybe I have to stop right there. But resistance at the beginning. Who could they be, you know? But this is not invading their privacy. I'm not talking about their spiritual practice, just what happened to them. But family, somewhat uneasy, you know, they're two very bright, capable young men, and now their parents just gave them a cabin. You know, said, go for it. Then I could give more lists. Another one, parents supporting him completely. He's built his fourth cabin now. Parents totally supporting him. Delighted. And so, but this karma and blessing business, you notice that what I've not done in this retreat, there's been no intimation or implication of it, is all right, if you're really interested about shamatha, 100,000 prostration, 100,000 mandala, 100,000, 100,000 this and this and this. I haven't said that. If people want to do that, I would never say, don't do it. But basically, the Buddha didn't say that, so I haven't. I'm just being really old-fashioned. But when the Buddha, people came to the Buddha, he didn't say, okay, hit the deck, you know, like a Marine. Let's have 100,000, you know, like push-ups. You know, he didn't do that. He simply taught them Dharma, and there it was. Here's the path, and the path is ethics, samadhi, and wisdom. I mean, that's the core path. It always has been. But what I found interesting, my interpretation of this, is I'm not at all disheartened, and I'm not even a smidgen discouraged that maybe out of a dozen or so students that are still continuing, they haven't achieved shamatha yet. In terms of just face value, if we got really quantitative here, where are you? Where were you 2.5 years ago, and where are you now on a scale of 1 to 9 prior to shamatha? Some of them you could say, whoa, you're getting nowhere. Stage 5, stage 6. Ah, you've hit a dead end. You must be really practicing correctly, or maybe it's hopeless, or maybe it's such a degenerate time that nobody can get beyond stage 6. I don't believe that for a microsecond. What's happening there, here's my interpretation. What's happening there is, I've not asked people to do 100,000 prostrations or 100,000 vajrasattva. Number one, it may be very purificatory and it may not. It all depends on motivation, faith, and so forth. This is the thing about Vajrayana. It's empowered by faith. If the faith is weak, the practice is weak. If the faith is powerful, it's enormously transformative. And I have deep faith in it, but I don't have deep faith that anybody who practices 100,000 Vajrasattva mantras or and so forth, that they're necessarily going to have a tremendous amount of purification from that. I don't believe that, and the tradition gives no reason for believing it. You don't have faith? Why would be reciting a mantra 100,000 times be, you know, profoundly purificatory? So not doing that, but watching at the type of obstacles that have arisen, and there have been a lot, over 2.5 years, lots of obstacles. Overwhelmingly, I would almost say 100%, but I don't think I could go quite that far. Overwhelmingly, the kind of challenges, obstacles, difficulties that these 12 or so have faced have been environmental. Environmental. Just not being able to stay to create or lease an environment, a cabin or what have you, where they could just sit down and practice for a year, 2 years, what have you. Not one has had that all the way through. Among these 12 or so who are still in retreat, not one. It was 6 months here and then fell apart. House is being sold. No longer, we can't lease it to you anymore. Then going here, oh, your visa ran out. So sorry, we can't extend your visa. Go back to Mexico. Okay, go to Mexico. Oh, so sorry, you got black widows and you got a really irascible landlady and she's pestering you all the time, making your life miserable. Whoops, okay, find another place. Oh, go, here's something really good. Here is a place for free. Travel across the country. This is right towards the beginning. Travel right, somebody's going to offer you a whole farmhouse for free. Just go fix it up a little bit. 4 or 5 of you can go into retreat, stay there as long as you like. The place was a dump. I mean, it was nobody's fault. It was a kind gesture. There's no criticism here. But it was impossible. There was a Boy Scout camp right next by with da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da-da, you know. Yeah. And Boy Scouts, teeming with Boy Scouts. You know, like not exactly what you want for your next door neighbors, because Boy Scouts are basically employed to make a lot of noise. And then the place was just hopeless. It was just hopeless. It was rats. It was leaky. It was offered with the best of motivations. And it was completely impossible. And these were young people, like young pioneers. But it was just not possible. So, okay, drive back across the country. And so it's, and then go up to Washington State. Ah, here's a place. It's owned by a Buddhist. Cabins, they'll take care of you. What they didn't mention is the guy who's overseeing, like the caretaker, he's Yosemite Sam. Yahoo! Whiskey! You know? Yee-haw! Guns and whiskey. You know, that was this guy's dharma. He wasn't one of the Buddhists. He was just some guy, I don't know, there. But, you know, one of the meditators almost got killed by him. And then another one took off, you know. So one of them said, I think I got to get away from Yosemite Sam here. And the other one says, well, he missed me last time. I guess he'll continue to miss me. And continue to meditate, you know, with drunk booze and bullets. You know, great combination if you like to live a short life. So one thing after another. But it's not going on and on and on. And this really makes me think as I stand back, Marpa, as far as I know, never asked Milarepa to hunker down and do 100,000 prostrations. I never, don't recall that ever happening. Or, okay, you killed 35 people, here, do 100,000, do 100,000 Vajrasattva, that'll do the trick. He didn't do that. As far as I know, I never saw that. It was, here's a wrathful manifestation of a guru. If you can bear this, this will purify everything. And Milarepa did. So what I sense, this is still a response, Ricardo, but among these people are dedicated. They're like a blade that's been in the fire and then chipped and chipped and chipped and back in the fire and then chipped and chipped and chipped. And I'm finding these people who've persevered through all the external adversity, from black widow spiders to Yosemite Sam to rats to all kinds of stuff coming up, is that the blade has been tested. And they've demonstrated it to their parents. Most of them are young. They've demonstrated it to their parents. And overall, there's still things to work out. These are not all now radiant bodhisattvas. You know, they're Dharma practitioners, and they're still in the process of purification. There's more work to be done. But my sense is a lot of purification is taking place in this process. You know, dealing with the adversities, checking their resolve, deepening the resolve. And their renunciation is really quite remarkable. Not a one is a monk or a nun. They're all living like monks and nuns. Every single one of them. Broad strokes. They don't have all the precepts, but pretty much, if you look at them, what are they doing that would be that would violate a monastic precept if they had them? Pretty much nothing. You know, really, real dedication. And so what's been happening just now over the last couple of months is that one by one, they're falling into place. And with help of Dharma friends, Joan Halifax, a very dear soul, old friend, has made wonderful land up at about 3,000 meters. She's provided the money. So the fellow who's built four cabins, this is his fourth cabin, it's a nice one, he's ready to hunker down. He's got now a place, it really looks like this is a keeper. Not that he owns, I don't think he owns the cabin, it belongs to the land, but Joan is there, and she's steadfast, and she's a good, good person. And now another one is just moving in. He had his purification working in a neuroscience lab for 2 years. That was his purification. But one can imagine what kind of people would be surrounded by. Now, this is a decent lab, and I know the director, he's a very good man. But it's not a Dharma place, it's a neuroscience lab. And yet, through all of that 2 years of working in the lab, where he could be, and he's very bright, he's very capable, he could flick his fingers three times, get a PhD, and you know, become a very accomplished neuroscientist himself. He asked me beforehand, because he came out of the Shamatha project with a very strong motivation. And he said, Alan, I have this opportunity here to go work in the neuroscience lab. I hope I'm not invading his privacy, because it's a nice story, and I'm not talking about his inner life, but I think maybe this is worth sharing. It's just impeccable. And that is, he said, you know, I've got this opportunity to be a researcher, and I'll put words in his mouth, in the foremost neuroscience lab in the country. I mean, it's at Princeton University. It doesn't get any better. There may be some that are as good, nothing better. And he could be a researcher in that. It was extremely competitive, and he was chosen. And he came to me and said, what do you think I should do? Shall I go there, spend some time there, and then go into retreat afterwards? Or shall I blow off that opportunity and just go into retreat now? I just listened to him closely. He said, go for the neuroscience lab. It's an opportunity I think you'll regret if you turn it down. Because it was fiercely competitive, like 1 out of 100 or something like that. And he put himself to the test. I didn't put him. I could sense he wanted to go. There was an attraction there. He put himself to the test. He put his own blade in the fire, being in an absolutely secular environment for 2 years, surrounded by brilliant people, high achievers, you know, really cutting edge. And coming out of 2 years and said, okay, I'm ready. He just had his blade in the fire for 2 years. And now his resolve is like iron. Like how do you say? Steel. So he's going to be joining up there in New Mexico. Noah be joining. Yeah, I think we can say that, yeah? Why not? Possible. But an opportunity is there. It's your choice. You're always free to choose where you go. So what I'm finding here, maybe I'm as usual using too many words, is that now one by one, these people who have tested themselves in the fires of experience, they're finding now for the first time after 3 years, 2.5, 3 years, now here's a place you can stay. You can go for it, you know, more and more. Some people from here also. So I don't think this, my intuition, no, this is empirical hypothesis. It can be in 2 years, 3 years can be show I was completely wrong about what I'm about to say. But here's my intuition. My sense is that for those of you who from here would like to go into long-term retreat, my sense is I don't think you'll have to face that type of obstacle. Don't think so. I think reality has shifted. We're not in 2007, we're in 2010. Reality has shifted. Things are coming together. This has come together. The network of retreat centers around the world that I've made contact with come together. A greater appreciation of scientific papers coming out on Shamatha Project. That's one facet as well. And so I wouldn't be at all surprised if those who are basically launching now can just go much in a straighter path without so many deviations from one hut to another, to here, to here, to here. But just more, okay, you want to practice shamatha? Good, practice shamatha. Practice shamatha, achieve shamatha. Okay? But karma, ripening, but also blessing. Not one came out of retreat because they couldn't afford it. Not really. So that's my best understanding. And ask me this question and again, and unless His Holiness or unless my own intuition tells me otherwise, when we do have, and I think this will not be, my intuition says, I don't think it's going to be terrible. I don't think we're going to have to wait 5 or 10 years. I think it'll be sooner than that. When again, like popcorn in a popcorn cooker, one pops and achieves something. And then the other little kernels say, if she can pop, I can pop. And if they can pop, I can pop. And after a while, we'll have a bowl full of popcorn. Shamatha popcorn. That's my expectation. We'll see. That's, again, something that can be proven true or false. But when we do have one or more gradually coming, as long as I know, see, what I've shared here is mundane. A person going to a neuroscience lab, well, if you checked out, you'd find out who it is. But everybody knows he, everybody knows, everybody who knows him knows he went to a neuroscience lab. Everybody who knows him knows he's now leaving the neuroscience lab and going into retreat. So there was no invasion of privacy there. But this is enormously important for me, that I don't invade people's privacy. So the two people that I referred to at Achieved Stage 7, I don't think you really have a clue. Unless you know it from them, and that's their business. You know? But when we do have, and I'll phrase it that way, as I will say so often and I'll keep on saying it, some things become true if and only you believe that they may become true. And if you're quite convinced they can't, well, you've just signed your own death warrant. You know, not death warrant, that's too overly dramatic. But if you don't believe it's possible, the chances of achieving it anyway are pretty slim. You know, getting a medical degree, if you get admitted into a medical school and feel I'm probably not smart enough, I'm probably not diligent enough, I probably don't have what it takes to get through medical school. What do you think, Adelina? If you're just defeating yourself all the way through, the chances of actually getting through, I think are probably pretty small. Because it's not easy, right? You've been through medical school. But if you're completely convincing yourself that you won't make it, you're not smart enough, you just don't have what it takes, I don't see how you get the inspiration, because it's not that much fun. You don't do it out of sheer fun. So, and shamatha is not always fun, but if you get into the medical school and say, I can do this, I got in, they accepted me because I'm capable, and I will now demonstrate that I'm capable, and I will get through because I have a strong motivation, this can be really beneficial. And it would be fun, it will be not fun, but I'm going to persevere. Those are the people who get through. And so if among people I'm helping out in Dharma, if there are those who achieve shamatha, it's going to be that because they believe in themselves. They have confidence in the practice, sufficient confidence in the teacher, but frankly, the teacher is the nozzle. The confidence in the teachings is what's really important, and confidence in themselves, enormously important. Then when this happens, and we have one, then we have two, we have three people achieving shamatha, as long as I have utter confidence that I can report it and protect their anonymity, then I'll let everybody know. Yeah. Why not? You know, I think people need to know. Okay? That's the answer to that. Then on quite an unrelated topic, and we have 2 minutes for a short question. That's good. What is the actual difference between ultimate bodhicitta and the wisdom realizing emptiness? Okay. First of all, I'll read the rest of it. This is actually short because I've covered it. So this doesn't have to be a 10 or 15 minute question. I think I can do it in maximum 7 minutes, probably a lot shorter. If they were exactly the same thing, ultimate bodhicitta and the wisdom realizing emptiness, then the arhats from the Shravakayana would be bodhisattvas, would they not? Not necessarily. But it depends on the context. So as I've mentioned before, in the context of Tsongkhapa's teachings, and of course he has his roots in classical India, great treatises of India, ultimate bodhicitta and the direct realization of emptiness are synonymous. Relative bodhicitta, we know ultimate bodhicitta is the realization of emptiness. Okay, but to realize ultimate bodhicitta does not mean that you've realized relative bodhicitta. Okay, so from Tsongkhapa's perspective, which is the Prasangika Madhyamaka perspective, a person following the Shravakayana who achieves stream entry has realized emptiness, therefore ultimate bodhicitta, but not relative bodhicitta, and then proceeds on and achieves arhatship. Right? Is that what you've heard? Or is it just a shift of terminology? Please do. You might be right. Isn't I was saying it's kind of graded a little bit, ultimate but not relative. I think you're right, Anila. Thank you. I think you've corrected me, and I think you've done so correctly. They would simply, in that context, the Shravakayana context, they would simply say this is realization of emptiness. If you're on the bodhisattva path, right, within the bodhisattva, the Mahayana context, that realization of emptiness, given your motivation, relative bodhicitta, then this manifests as the deep underpinning, the ultimate bodhicitta. So, good. Thank you. That was a helpful correction, because I don't like to make these blatant errors. And even though it's terminological, words count. Words really matter. Whereas if we go to the Dzogchen, now it's 6 o'clock, when we go to the Dzogchen, the words are simply being used differently. The words are simply being used differently. And words never define themselves. And so it's a different lineage. And that happens all the time in Buddhism. So it's not like they're refuting Tsongkhapa, refuting Prasangika Madhyamaka. It's Dzogchen context. So there we are. In that context, as you well know, ultimate bodhicitta is nothing other than Rigpa, Dharmakaya, Buddha nature. It's the same. Which then, and now I don't need to reiterate because I think I've done as clear a job as I can to show the difference that one may realize emptiness without realizing Buddha nature. But if you have become a vidyadhara and gained a direct, unmediated, non-dual realization of Rigpa, you have necessarily realized emptiness. Okay? So that distinction. But I've covered that ground in the past. So is that sufficiently clear? Good. Our last afternoon. Let's have our last meal. Our last, I won't say it. Our last dinner. I won't say it, the last supper. That just sounds a bit too heavy. Our last chow down. Let's have some grub. And thank you, Elizabeth, for your specs.